I want to get to Dr. Dresner's case.
This is a 56-year-old housewife who presented with a painful swelling in her right breast. Her mammogram was equivocal, but a needle biopsy showed a poorly differentiated lobular carcinoma. She had a lumpectomy and node dissection. Pathology showed a 3-centimeter lobular carcinoma with 2 of 16 nodes positive for metastatic disease. ER was negative, PR was negative, and HER2 was negative. She received dose-dense adriamycin cytoxan followed by Taxol. Radiation was then given to the right breast. She remained well for about 16 months and then came in complaining of abdominal pain with increasing abdominal girth. CAT scan of the abdomen and pelvis revealed ascites with nodularity in the peritoneum. Pelvic portion showed the ovaries to be normal. A PET scan was done and it was positive only in the abdomen. CA27 and CA125 were both normal. She then had a paracentesis, which showed an exudative fluid but negative cytology. She then had a laparoscopy, which on biopsy was positive for lobular carcinoma.
And what was her clinical state at that point?
She was otherwise fairly healthy, and other than being uncomfortable because of the abdominal pain and swelling, was in very good clinical condition.
George?
Do we know whether or not she has any intestinal wall involvement?
It appeared to be peritoneal seeding.
Okay. Well, it's very interesting. If you look at lobular carcinomas and their pattern of metastasis, they do have a greater likelihood of having a visceral pattern of metastasis. And indeed, I've got several patients with lobular carcinomas who've had involvement of either the gastric or the small bowel wall. So don't be surprised if that shows up down the road a little bit. Given that this is metastatic lobular carcinoma, and given that she's had prior anthracycline and taxane-based therapy, she, of course, is someone who's at significant risk of dying of breast cancer in the not-too-distant future. She's triple negative, and she's failed adjuvant therapy. In terms of treatment options for this patient, by virtue of being more than a year out, interestingly enough, she is a patient who would have been allowed to go on E2100. And we, in E2100, had about one-fifth of the patients in that trial and actually had prior adjuvant taxane-based chemotherapy. And we did that for the worst of reasons, which is that as chair of the breast committee of ECOG, I was afraid we weren't going to get enough patients on the trial. So we allowed the patients to go on the trial. And again, following up on what Peter said earlier, the reason you throw your gates fairly wide open on these trials is that your initial biases are frequently wrong. And our biases were absolutely wrong in this population of patients. If we look in E2100, the patients who were triple negative did just as well, got just as much benefit as the patients who were estrogen receptor positive. But more importantly, the patients who had had prior adjuvant taxane also got a lot of benefit from the addition of bevacizumab to taxane therapy. So patients on that trial who got weekly paclitaxel plus bevacizumab went from a median progression-free survival of 4 months to a progression-free survival of 12 months. Actually, it's the largest absolute improvement in progression-free survival that we see in that trial is adding bevacizumab in this setting. And the best hazard ratio in the trial, not surprisingly, also is in this subpopulation of patients. So because of that, this is a patient I'd feel pretty comfortable giving her weekly paclitaxel and bevacizumab.
How would you have treated her a year ago? Before the E2100, how would you have approached a patient like this?
Well, I would have approached her differently because I would have said that taxanes and anthracyclines had failed the patient, and therefore it was reasonable to move on to something else. And indeed, 2100 says the same thing. Weekly paclitaxel in that setting has a progression-free survival of 4 months. So I would have recommended some single-agent chemotherapeutic in my clinic. That probably would have been capecitabine as my initial therapy, though I would certainly have no trouble if someone had wanted to start with gemcitabine or nalbuphine.
The reason I bring that up is because I know you and Kathy Miller are very pro-capecitabine, where you had been prior to the E2100. In our patterns of care data, we've also surveyed breast cancer clinical investigators. Perhaps that's somehow reimbursement or revenue related. And now that the bevacizumab data is on, now when we do the patterns of care study, it's kind of an interesting split because I'm starting to see a bunch of people who, in spite of the, quote, negative capecitabine bevacizumab study, are using that combination, talking about the doubling in response rate, ease on the patients. What are your thoughts about that regimen in a patient like this?
Well, we don't know. If you look at patients who progressed on anthracyclines and taxanes and then get bevacizumab plus capecitabine, you do get about a 10% improvement in response rate for the addition of bevacizumab to capecitabine in that setting. You get no improvement in progression-free survival or overall survival in the randomized trial. And it was called a negative trial based upon the failure of its primary endpoint of progression-free survival. Those patients, by and large, were reasonably beat-up patients. So, you know, a reasonable question to ask is, well, why did bevacizumab not add much in that setting? My suspicion is that if you put nice drugs in bad neighborhoods, they get beat up, and that's probably just what happened there. We're currently actually involved in a frontline capecitabine plus bevacizumab trial that actually will be closing to accrual probably in the next month or two, where we'll get a little better look at this particular type of patient where you're actually giving it as frontline therapy for metastatic disease.
It's phase two?
It's a phase two trial, reasonably well-powered. It's going to end up with about 112 patients.
Peter, again, this patient today, a malignant ascites, prior AC paclitaxel, what would you likely utilize?
Well, my strategy would be very similar to George's, and I would be likely to use a weekly paclitaxel regimen, and then the question is whether or not to add something to it. Bevacizumab would be something that would be reasonable. I also like capecitabine. I have to say that I would be a little bit tempted to be more aggressive in a patient like this, just in that she's symptomatic. So she's got a fair amount of disease on board. But if she were asymptomatic, I would certainly start her with capecitabine.
Let's follow up with Dr. Dresner's case, too, because I think there's a point to be made there. Now, this lady was treated in the pre-bevacizumab era, correct?
Right.
What did you do and what happened?
Well, she was started on capecitabine, had a very nice response. Her abdominal pain improved. There was no recurrence of her fluid. 3-month follow-up CAT scan showed improved scan, and she's continuing on that. And it's about 9.5 months out, and her husband is a pharmacist, came to me recently and asked whether Avastin should be added because he heard that's the new drug that everybody should be on for breast cancer.
You know, it's just interesting, George, again, getting into this single-agent, kinder, gentler approach in metastatic disease, and then the bevacizumab data comes out, and it almost seems like your philosophy changed.
My objections to combination therapy have been largely based on the fact that we have no data, repeat, zero data, suggesting that combination therapy is superior to sequential single-agent therapy. Combination therapy is clearly more toxic for the average patient, and it's clearly more expensive to the healthcare system. So I feel very comfortable for the vast majority of my patients offering them sequential single-agent therapy. I think when we move out of chemotherapy and move into biologic therapies, we're talking about something very different. And there, for instance, we chose weekly paclitaxel plus bevacizumab because we had reasonably significant preclinical data suggesting that it was a synergistic combination. And I think that's different than just kind of tossing a couple of chemotherapy drugs that have been randomly selected together with no proven benefit over using them sequentially.
What was your take on Hal Burstein's metronomic presentation using Cytoxan methotrexate with bevacizumab at San Antonio?
Yeah, well, this is very interesting data that's based on some interesting preclinical work. And the preclinical work basically says that how we've been giving chemotherapy for the last couple generations now may well have been wrong. And that's to say that we have always viewed chemotherapy as primarily targeting the cancer cell, whereas it is reasonably clear from preclinical data that chemotherapy also can target the tumor vascular endothelium, and that the best way to target that tumor vascular endothelium is not by giving a bolus of chemotherapy, but rather by bathing the tumor in low doses of chemotherapy on a constant basis. And there's decent preclinical data suggesting that when you do that and then add a VEGF-targeting agent, that you get synergistic effects against vascular endothelium and you kill a lot of tumor cells. So the Burstein trial, which was presented in San Antonio, was attempting to look at that. And it randomized patients either to receive low-dose so-called metronomic chemotherapy with daily oral Cytoxan and 2 days a week low-dose methotrexate, either by itself or with bevacizumab. Now, it was not a phase 3 trial. It was a randomized phase 2 trial. And in the low-dose chemotherapy arm, the response rate was pretty low. It was 10 or 11%. The combination arm did significantly better than that. It had about a 29% overall response rate. That's not randomized trial data in any phase 3 sense, but it certainly suggests the possibility that that low-dose approach is a reasonable one.
Dr. Dresner, what dose of capecitabine did you use in this lady? How did she tolerate it, and did you have to adjust it?
Started on 1,000 milligrams per meter squared, BID, and it was fairly well tolerated. She had grade 2 hand foot, moderate diarrhea. Adjusted it once or twice along the way when the hand foot got a little worse, but pretty much that was the average dose for most of the treatment cycles.
And so at this point, is she kind of stabilized out in terms of the dose and side effects?
Yes, very much so.
And has she had any reaccumulation of the ascites?
None.
A question. And Dr. Dresner's patient with the peritoneal implants and probably bowel involvement, would you anticipate her to be at significant risk for bowel perforation with the Avastin, or is that kind of more unique to the colorectal patients?
Well, we don't have data. It's certainly not unique to the colorectal patients because it's been seen in the ovarian cancer patients as well. So something about either having tumor around your gut in the case of ovarian cancer or manipulating your gut in the case of colorectal cancer is a setup for doing that. So yeah, you wouldn't be astonished if this subpopulation had a higher rate of gut perforation.
Dr. Lowenthal?
Just a general question about the use of Avastin. My sense is, from listening to the panel, that on a certain level, this has been a paradigm shift, and that the standard of care maybe should be that Avastin should be used in first-line metastatic disease almost as a matter of routine. In the community, it's not that easy. And in point of fact, it's a source of an enormous challenge, an enormous frustration, getting access to this drug, at least in our state. In the state of New Jersey, for Medicare patients, Avastin has only been approved for advanced colorectal cancer. And there's no petitioning, there's no written form to request it. It is all or nothing. For managed care, quite frankly, other than Aetna, which has approved it to its credit pretty much across the board in renal cell, lung, breast cancer, as well as colorectal cancer, you basically have to offer the drug, bill for it, wait for the denial, and then appeal it, which is a long and onerous process. And with all the indications now that Avastin seems to have, this is a tremendous burden on community-based oncology practices.
Bill? I have a woman in her mid-40s, triple negative, treated this past year, presented with a fairly sizable breast mass. On her initial evaluation, she had a few areas of PET positivity that looked like very well could be distant mets, no other X-ray correlation. I gave her dose-dense chemotherapy. She then had nice shrinkage of the breast mass, PET scan normalized at the end of chemotherapy. She had her lumpectomy and radiation. She now comes back this past week, rip-roaring widespread metastatic disease. Bone, LS spine, pelvis, some liver, really enough pain. She had like perineal numbness that I really had to get radiation started. I had an option for a possible Zolotovastin trial, but she was ineligible because of any concomitant radiation. I had seen her one day earlier with some eye symptoms that had only been present for a day, and then she called again today, so we ordered an MRI. Now she has two brain mets, some cavernous sinus involvement that's near the optic nerve. She's going to need to start radiation there. I had started Zolota, couldn't think of anything else. 20 family members in the room, what can we do? Anything we can do? Any other ideas? And her breast cancer surgeon says, can't you present her at this meeting with Dr. Love, see if anyone has any other ideas?
Here we are. George?
I'm sure Dr. Love has the answer. How far out is the patient from her angiogram?
Less than a year. She only finished her radiation 2-3 months ago. She's under 6 months from completion of the Taxol.
And she got anthracycline taxane.
She got anthracycline. And she did respond. I mean, her breast mass definitely shrunk nicely. And her labs, like she's a little anemic. LFTs are okay, but her LDH is 2200, which sort of struck me. And another question is, I haven't biopsied her. And I was also suggesting maybe we should just biopsy this, although she was classic infiltrating ductal carcinoma in her breast.
So I'm assuming you biopsy it. So really, this is the aggressive side of Dr. Dresner's case.
Yes. Sure.
So George, does that change it?
Well, E2100 did not allow patients in who had had a relapse within a year of their adjuvant taxane. So this group we don't have any data on for Avastin, but certainly it makes you a lot less comfortable when you have a fairly rapid relapser like this.
Plus the brain would be a relative contraindication.
Yes. We don't know, actually, because we haven't looked, though virtually every bevacizumab trial that's been done has excluded patients with central nervous system metastasis, rightly or wrongly.
I've heard it has activity in gliomas.
Yes. Several anti-angiogenics probably have activity in gliomas. Whether or not that means it's safe to give it to a breast cancer patient with a brain metastasis is a different question.
Correct.
Historically, I can tell you exactly why we haven't done that, and that is that in the phase one trial that we did at Indiana University, we had a patient who had hepatoma who bled into a previously asymptomatic brain metastasis. And every other trial after that excluded patients from receiving bevacizumab in the presence of a brain metastasis. So we have zero data. But I'd say both for the brain metastasis reason and for the fairly rapid relapse after adjuvant taxane use, this is probably a patient I would not use taxane, bevacizumab combination in and would definitely go to something else once her radiation therapy was completed.
Something else being?
I would still probably use a single agent therapy in this patient. There's nothing wrong with the Xeloda. There's nothing wrong with gemcitabine. There's nothing wrong with nalbuphine.
What about Xeloda-Taxotere?
I find Xeloda-Taxotere personally pretty tough on my patients, and we have no data that it's any better than giving sequential therapy. And again, because this patient had progression on a taxane less than a year ago, the likelihood of this patient getting great benefit from further taxane therapy, I'd say, is quite small.
Peter, what would you recommend a pills patient?
I wouldn't use single-agent therapy in this patient. What I would use is either Taxotere Xeloda or Taxotere Carboplatin. And I'm just looking for agents that this patient's not seen. And patients like this are neoadjuvant patients, for instance, in a way almost she's of this category, do uniformly really badly, even with crossover regimens. But the idea of giving her more than one agent in this situation, because she's clearly got just absolutely devastatingly rapid progression.
Can I query you on this? Because you started off by saying that you generally agreed with me about using single-agent sequential therapy, and yet every single case you've recommended combination therapy.
No,
so does that mean that you ignore the only randomized database that we have and give everyone combination therapy?
No, no.
What, Peter?
Well,
I'm curious.
No, I'll tell you what it means. It means that a number of the cases that have been presented have actually had what I would describe as impending visceral crisis. And so that...
What does that mean?
I think what that means is that a major organ system like your brain is being, or your liver...
But her brain's being irradiated.
Didn't your study show that there was a greater response rate when you'd use combination therapy initially?
Sure. It was a 10% greater response rate in a population of patients, three-quarters of them who had never received prior adjuvant therapy.
We've all seen most recurrences, single met in the liver, a couple mets in the liver, you know, bone, somebody cough, and something shows up in the chest x-ray. Those are the people that I feel absolutely comfortable with single agent therapy. But once you're in a performance status 2 going on 3, I'm not actually comfortable with single agent therapy.
But that's exactly the patient who's most likely to have significant toxicity with a combination like docetaxel and capecitabine. Absolutely positively the patient who's likely to get sickest with the therapy that you just recommended.
That's true, although I think that the difference in response rate is really important because sometimes you only are going to get one real roll of the dice. And if you're going to get one roll of the dice, I want to roll with something that has the highest probability of response.